Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. Our case this morning is United States v. St. Jean. At the outset, I'd like to note that Senior Judge Stuckey is going to be the fifth judge for today's oral argument in light of the long-term vacancy on the court, and we are very grateful to Judge Stuckey for being willing to serve in this capacity. So let's begin. Mr. Hockenberry, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Captain Hopkins, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed, Mr. Hockenberry.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Scott Hockenberry. Along with Captain Tung Soo Armstrong, we represent the appellant, Specialist Nicholas St. Jean. Chief Judge Olson, could I reserve 5 minutes, please?
Granted.
There was very little dispute in this case that the charged act had taken place on the charged date. The dispute, rather, was between the government theory she was asleep and the defense theory that she was awake and consenting. The defense had some good evidence, but the defense also had a problem. Why would MC be interested in having sex with appellant, a man whom she had just met, in the middle of the night with no apparent lead-up or discussion or history? Apparently just totally out of the blue. And for that matter, why would appellant think it was okay to go into her barracks room in the middle of the night and try to have sex with her? Again, just out of the blue. Well, there was an answer to these questions, Your Honors, a pretty good answer, but the panel never heard it. The answer, of course, was that there was a history, there was a lead-up, there was discussion between these two people in that same barracks room from the day before, or maybe 36 hours before. But again, the panel never heard about it. This was textbook evidence of prior sexual behavior between accused and accuser. Military appellate courts have repeatedly and consistently found error in the exclusion of such evidence, often on facts far less egregious than these.
Now, can we explore that a little bit? So much of this case revolves around the issue of the determination by the military judge that, for lack of a better word, I'm going to use the phrase kissing session, the probative value of that kissing session. So I'd like to explore that a little bit. In your brief, you characterize the kissing session as follows. It involved no removal of clothes and no touching of private areas. And then earlier in your brief, you're talking about a number of instances where the lower courts, the service CCAs, actually found an abuse of discretion by the military judge when the military judge did not admit the evidence because of the probative value of it. With Zach, and I'm comparing this kissing session where there was no removal of clothes and no touching of private areas to the facts in those types of cases. Zach, virtually a nude sexual massage, Thomas, sexual text messages, Harrington, sexual body shots, Lopez, kissing and consensual digital penetration. How, in looking at those, do we make a determination that the military judge abused his discretion when he said this kissing session, which was very tame, had very low probative value in terms of 36 hours later, whether there would be consent to full-blown sexual intercourse?
Yes, sir. Well, it's not uncommon for sexual relationships to begin with a lower level of intimacy and progress to a higher level of intimacy, which is exactly what happened here. Another case we had cited, of course, fact patterns differ, but Rankin, that involved arguably an even lower prior conduct, where it was still ruled an abuse of discretion to exclude it. That was just kind of flirting and almost childlike behavior on a camping trip. So I certainly don't think there's a rule that in order to be probative, the prior act has to involve what you might term a higher level sex act. To the contrary, these people had just met. So the fact that they had a pretty rapidly developing sexual relationship here that started with kissing and then progressed to intercourse, I see the relevance of that is quite high.
Well, and I understand your point fully. to say that it progressed from kissing to full-blown sexual intercourse, from the military judge's perspective, it wasn't a progression, it was a jump. It was a large leap. And so when we're looking at this, and I understand that one thing we need to discuss and that you'll be arguing is the proper standard of review by this court, if this court were to decide that abuse of discretion is the proper standard, how would we look at that where a military judge says, you jump from something that would happen in the 1950s at a church social to full-blown sexual intercourse? How is that an abuse of discretion for him to make a determination that the probative value of that kissing session was, as he put it, very low?
Well, Your Honor, I guess the alternative would be that they just went from doing nothing to having sexual intercourse, which is the facts the defense was artificially stuck with, which is problematic. So if the alternative is between nothing to spontaneous intercourse in the middle of the night or nothing to kissing with some discussion and some other things and then intercourse the next day or early in the morning of the day following, the latter is, well, one, that's what actually happened, so the panel should have been able to consider it. But two, that has great relevance because the leap is so significant when you exclude that.
Counsel, how much does it matter, or how does it weigh into the analysis that here the Judge Wilson's questions just sort of treated it as definitive evidence that the kissing session happened? But I think in reality we have the appellant's testimony that it happened, and we have the victim's statements to investigators, at least, that it never happened. This isn't a third-party witness. This isn't cell phone video. This isn't something more definitive. So how does that, the character of the evidence, weigh into the 403 analysis?
Your Honor, with respect to the 412 analysis, I think the weight of the evidence or the fact that there is competing evidence is irrelevant. It's a prohibited consideration, as this court said in Roberts and Banker. With respect to 403, the government has argued, although the military judge never articulated this, that the fact that there was competing evidence would lead to a trial within a trial. I don't know of any authority, and the government hasn't cited any, that 412 evidence can be excluded under 403 because there's competing evidence. Really, that's just a proxy for what this court has said is a prohibited analysis of a credibility determination.
I mean, does it go to the probative value of the evidence?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to 412, it's more about the subject matter than the form of the evidence. But to the extent that we do look to the weight of the evidence, which I don't think is a proper consideration, but if you did look to the weight of the evidence here, the weight of the evidence was pretty strong. I mean, they had hickeys on appellant right afterwards with two third-party witnesses who the government acknowledged would confirm them.
Well, to be fair, we don't know exactly when those occurred, and we don't know during which how they occurred. What we know, there's evidence to suggest that the hickeys existed the day after the alleged assault. And the kissing session was
the day
36 or 48 hours earlier.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that would...
I mean, this is all part of the analysis, right? All of these considerations go into the 403 analysis, right?
Well, Your Honor, the Air Force Court, I believe in Lionheart, had said the fact that the victim denies a sexual encounter is an improper basis to exclude it under 412. Even if you're just looking at cross-examination because defense has the right to ask her about it, or him or her, in this case her, and the panel, even if they deny it, the panel may not believe the denial. So that alone, we think, would be enough. But there's much more here. I suppose they...
I'm just assuming it's admissible under 412B2.
Mm-hmm. Right?
But then that doesn't mean it necessarily gets admitted. There's more analysis that has to be done. And I will concede that the military judge's explanation, perhaps on the record, wasn't maybe as fulsome as one might hope. But nevertheless, in reviewing this for error, we're not limited, right, by what the military judge wrote in his order. In the explanation he gave, we have to make all of these, we have to consider all of these things. And I'm just asking, do you agree that those are all relevant considerations under 403?
Well, Your Honor, I think the range of relevant considerations under 403 is very broad. I mean, it could be almost anything. But does the fact that there's competing evidence mean that the prejudicial value substantially outweighs the probative value? On these facts, I don't think that's a close call.
Mr. Hockenberry, I don't think the military judge, and maybe I think I'm misunderstanding Judge Hardy's question. I think he was posing it, focusing on that one element of this. But I thought the military judge based his findings or conclusions on more than just the credibility. He actually says that that's not an issue when I'm making my 412 analysis. What he did say was that one of the things to be taken into consideration on his 403 analysis is the extent to which the issue is in dispute, I think is the language he uses in his written findings. So isn't that different than, first of all, he didn't base it even only on that. He had some other reasons for why he thought there was the danger of unfair prejudice in this case by admitting that evidence, as you may recall. I think it's on page 5 of his written findings. But so am I correct in my understanding that he didn't really base his conclusion on the fact that, the actual testimony was, one testimony from the accused and testimony from the victim that she denying what had happened. So he had a whole bunch of other things in there.
Your Honor, you are correct. That was not the rationale by the military judge. That is a rationale that Judge Hardy was asking about that the government has argued. That was not articulated by the military judge. The rationale articulated by the military judge was that the panel could view this prior encounter as an invitation for sexual abuse. And that related to, in addition to the kissing, he showed appellant
a picture
and talked about some of her sexual preferences, which were arguably somewhat alternative. But that 403 concern, which was the only 403 concern the military judge articulated, had no relevance to the kissing. No military panel member is going to be shocked by the fact that two lower enlisted soldiers are kissing in a barracks room. That's about as unoffensive as...
Well, isn't he considering the whole so-called make-out session here as, when he refers to the evidence, he's talking about, as I understood it, he's talking about the kissing, whatever else was going on there, and then the so-called marks or hickeys that the accused claims she left on him, and the discussion and the showing of the picture. He's talking about all of that, isn't he?
Well, he doesn't specify. I think the best reading of the military judge's very brief 403 analysis, and the single 403 concern he articulates, is that it relates to her statement about her preference for somewhat rough sexual activities, which I think is, that may be, but that has nothing to do with the kissing. I mean, kissing is as vanilla as 412 evidence can be.
Right, so what you seem to be arguing at this point is that the judge should have at least have let in the fact that there was this kissing going on the first day that the two met.
Yes, sir.
That is relevant to However, whatever the probative value is, it's relevant to his later perception that she would consent to have him come to her room and have,
yes,
have sex with her.
To his perception and to actual consent.
Counsel, I'm sorry, did you finish answering the question?
Yeah, no, I am, sir.
I'm sorry. Can you just ask a very specific question about the military judge and the race jesty question? It sounded like the first military judge excluded the evidence of the Hickeys based on the idea of 412, and then there was the motion before the second military judge, and the military judge said, but wait, we already have a ruling on those Hickeys. And after some initial confusion, it was clarified that, well, there were Hickeys both on the defense theory was of Hickeys both on the third and on the fourth. And the military judge said, well, what's the proof of that? And there wasn't anything stated in the earlier motions. And the statement was, well, I can get you evidence. He said, what's your proffer? And the counsel then said, I'll move on, but I'll get back to you. And my question is, did the military judge ever rule that the evidence couldn't come in as race jesty? Did we ever get a ruling on that, or did they just sort of say, I'll move, I'll get back to you, and then they never got back to you?
Chief Judge Olson, if I could answer.
Please do.
Your Honor, I agree the record is not as clean as it could be. We see the ruling on JA 356 and again on 357, the ruling by the new military judge being that the prior military judge had excluded all evidence of Hickeys.
But then afterwards there was a clarification, and he said, yeah, but there were Hickeys both on the third and the fourth. And then the judge said, oh, well, what's the evidence of that? And he said, get back to him. And I, you know, the military judge sort of asked the question, well, you've lost me on how you can get this in when the previous military judge has already ruled it out. And if it stopped there, I would agree. But it kind of seemed like it didn't stop there.
It didn't, Your Honor. And it is, I would say, somewhat confusing, some of the statements. And it seems like the new military judge read the prior military judge's written ruling but did not review the transcript where he specifically said that the race jesty Hickeys would not be 412 evidence. But how we would interpret it is there's the ruling on.
But of course, the first military judge didn't specifically say you can bring it in as race jesty. He said, if you're talking about something that happened during the sexual encounter, that would be race jesty. But at that point, there was no sort of proffer that something had happened at that point. I mean, if there had been, then in the second hearing, they would have pointed to that, I would have thought.
Right, Your Honor. I think the military judge at the 412 hearing, the old military judge, or the
Judge Watkins.
Yes, sir. I think his impression or his statements were this is not necessary to talk about at a 412 hearing because it's not 412. It's race jesty. So he did not make a explicit ruling, but when you say something is race jesty, that's probably coming in. It certainly was not what the new military judge characterized it as a ruling that all Hickeys were excluded. So to return to the defense counsel moving on, and of course we don't think the defense counsel should have moved on from this point until we think he should have stuck with it, but to be fair, the judge was pretty heavy-handed with him. But We would view the ruling as occurring on JA 356 and 357, and then the discussion after that we would characterize as a request for reconsideration under RCM 905 Foxtrot. The defense counsel didn't say seeking reconsideration, but the judge had made a ruling, and the defense counsel kept trying to get him to change his mind. So that's how we would characterize that.
Thank you.
Ms. Hockenberry, you noted that in his ruling, the military judge only specifically referred to one line of reasoning for his MRE 403 analysis. What are we to make of the fact that in what is concededly boilerplate language, he lays out, the military judge lays out the various factors for 403, and then prior to this specific instance says MRE 403 concerns abound. So should we essentially incorporate by reference when he says they abound and he's cited the correct factors of 403 that, in fact, what he's doing is he's saying there are a number of these that apply. I'm only going to articulate one because this may be less self-evident than the others.
Well, Your Honor, this court's case law would be that in the absence of a record putting the MRE 403 concerns on the record, conducting the analysis on the record, less deference will be applied. So simply saying there are a lot of MRE 403 concerns without saying what they are.
Right, but that's not what Judge Olson is asking. I think Chief Judge is asking, what are we to do with the fact that he says, in my mind, there are all kinds of 403 concerns here. And implicitly what he's saying, and here's an example of one, and he puts that one as in his findings. And the question I think that Chief Judge Egan, I can't speak for him, he can speak for himself, he's a grown man. But the question then is, are we really fair in alleging that the military judge based his 403 conclusion on just that one, concern, when he, in fact, as the Chief Judge pointed out, apparently in his mind, he thinks that the 403 concerns abound.
I mean, Your Honor, he may have some internal secret concerns that he doesn't want to share with us. I mean, that's...
Well, the question is, does he have to put all of them on there, on the record?
Well, I think he certainly does need, in order to secure full deference or maximum deference.
Because he does the 403 analysis, lays out, as the Chief Judge explained, lays out the whole rule, mm-hmm. all the definitions within the rule, right? And on top of the fact that don't we presume the military judge knows the law, unless the record indicates otherwise?
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, it's an abuse of discretion to exclude evidence under 403 without an articulated or supportable basis. Here, we'd say there's no articulated basis. And just saying, I have a lot of concerns that I'm not going to articulate is not an articulated basis.
But I thought you were taking issue with the fact that he only articulated one. Because he did articulate one.
Yes, Your Honor. The one he did articulate, we think, is invalid or certainly...
Right, but that's... You're not the judge, right? And I'm not the judge. And so under the abuse of discretion standard, which I understand we might be talking about that later, but under the abuse of discretion standard, disagreement is not enough, is it? The fact that Judge Sparks, Judge Olson would have decided something else, or you,
Your Honor,
become a judge, you would have decided something else is completely irrelevant on that.
Well, a mere difference of opinion is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
However, there needs to be, in the absence of an articulated basis, there needs to be a supportable basis. And there is no supportable 403 basis for excluding kissing between soldiers in a barracks room. Right. If 403 could exclude that, it would completely swallow up 412, and it could exclude everything.
I understand. I won't believe it. Thank you, Chief Judge, for indulging me.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Eikenberry.
Thank you, Your
Taylor.
Honor.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Andrew Hopkins. Along with Major Pamela Jones, we represent the United States. This court should affirm the conviction because the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he excluded evidence of a prior consensual romantic encounter. Exclusion of the encounter was proper because appellant offered the evidence in support of his consent theory, but the government charged appellant with sexually assaulting the victim while she was asleep. Under the facts of this case, the probative value of this evidence to prove consent was substantially outweighed by the dangers of unfair prejudice and confusing issues. There are two points I'd like to make for you this morning, Your Honors. The first, to the extent that this evidence had any relevance at all, the probative value of that evidence was substantially outweighed by 403 concerns. And the second point, the military judge did not prevent appellant from presenting evidence of participation and consent during the rite of gestae of this offense because appellant never supplied any such evidence. As far as the record is concerned, the marks, to the extent that there were marks, came from the encounter on the 3rd. And I would just preface my remarks, unless I...
Counsel, you're dropping off, and I'm having trouble hearing you.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
Thank you.
For the purpose of my remarks this morning, I will assume, for the sake of argument, that the encounter on the 3rd happened, so as to not belabor my remarks with qualifying statements every time.
Counsel, one thing that immediately springs to mind here with your argument is the fact, and the defense counsel raises it in their reply brief, on page 15 you write, the government, through its charging decision, has effectively removed any issue of consent from the equation. What do you mean by that? Why are you saying that based on how the government charged this offense, that the accused was somehow prevented from raising a defense of, in fact, there was consent on the part of the victim?
I certainly didn't mean to suggest that proposition, Your Honor.
So what did you mean to suggest by that language I just cited in your brief?
Merely to highlight the observation made by this court, that the elements of this offense were that the sex act occurred, that the victim was asleep at the time, and that the appellant should have known. Now, it's true. If the appellant is able to show that the victim consented, he has effectively shown that she's awake. But we're already kind of one step removed from a straightforward direct connection there, which is why this evidence is really has to be unpacked in a way that would have been confusing to the panel members.
But what about the defense point of, from the perspective of the panel members, based on the ruling of the military judge, all of a sudden this victim finds in her room a person she hardly knows. She uses the term weird, that the encounter was weird, so that from the perspective of the panel members, this is going from essentially no interaction to full-blown sexual intercourse. The defense's point is, wait a minute, even if this was, quote-unquote, merely a kissing session, that this indicates some type of intimacy that could have evolved more understandably in the minds of the panel members rather than going from 0 to 100.
That's correct. And just to comment on one of the things that, that appellants argued this morning about how she kind of found him inexplicably in her room that night. Well, of course, there was the evidence that she gave him her room key, so that would account for that particular confusion to the extent that there was any. Secondly, the point of the encounter on the May 3rd, what it shows and the reason why it's relevant at all, and one could be forgiven to find that it had no relevance, but the military judge found that it had very slight relevance, and here's why. Because if she had this consensual encounter with him on the 3rd, it would make it more likely that she would have had a consensual encounter with him on the 5th. Or, you could state it differently, it makes it more likely, however so slightly, that she actually did consent on the 5th. They're two different things, but it does go to both of those. However, when you look at how it does that and the probative value of this evidence as to those issues, whether she would have consented or whether she actually did consent, that is so attenuated as to strain the tolerance of a panel member.
Well, why is it so attenuated other than your ipsy dixit?
For the mere reason that an inference that because somebody made out on the 3rd would then later consent to an encounter on the 5th, that's not a straightforward proposition at all.
Well, it's not a straightforward proposition, but neither is it beyond the bounds of logic.
And I would agree, and we do agree with the judge when he found that there was relevance. So therefore, by definition, there was some probative value here. But exactly what it's probative of is far from obvious. And it's greatly outweighed by the concern of confusing the panel members. What are they here to decide? Would she have consented? What happened on the 3rd? What exactly was going on between these two? Really, the question they were asked to answer was she awake when appellant came into her room and had sex with her? That was the question that they were asked to answer based on the way that the government charged
it. But it seems by framing it that way, again, you're removing the ability of the defense to say, not only was she awake, she consented. And this goes to the issue of whether the panel has the broader context of the relationship.
So, again, I would take issue with the characterization that the accused was not able to put on a consent defense. Of course, he did that through the testimony of a witness who said that the victim admitted as much to him directly by saying, yes, I had sex with the accused, yes, it was consensual. So consent was on the table. The appellant was able to put that out there. The issue of whether or not they had this session on the 3rd, however, is just really not germane enough to overcome the 403 concerns, the abounding, I believe Your Honor's phrase was self-evident, really, concerns that the military judge observed in his ruling. It was just a distraction for the panel members to try to connect the dots from a consensual encounter on the 3rd to this instance where he comes into her room at night while she's asleep, while she has a tampon in, which was one of the strengths of the government's case, very strong evidence that she was, in fact, asleep as she claimed, as she went back to her room, went to sleep. She had asked appellant to come bring her the water, etc. He comes back later. I mean, the government's case was that she was asleep. That's the way they charged it, and that's what they proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And the military judge, in arriving at his decision to exclude evidence of the encounter on the 3rd, well, he correctly stated the law. He made no errors with respect to findings of fact. He did not abuse his discretion in any way. Now, he relied on Andreozzi, of course, looking at the similarity or dissimilarity in this case of the two charged acts. We would argue, as well as the specific dissimilarities of what actually happened, kissing versus sex, but also the fact that in the second case, the victim was asleep, which, again, puts it really in a whole different ballgame.
Counsel, on that point, moving beyond just the facts of this case, as I read appellant's brief, they say that, well, if the government then charges the act as being occurring when the victim was unable to consent because the victim was asleep, that would effectively prevent any kind of defense because the only defense that would be valid would be she wasn't asleep, and if you're not going to testify, how are you ever going to get any evidence that she wasn't asleep? And I think that's their theory, which is that, well, if this is true, that in all future cases, they'll charge that the victim was asleep, and there won't be any evidence except for the victim's testimony, I was asleep.
Or witness testimony that she admitted it later, or any number of variety of evidence that could come in to that point. I mean, this is no different. There are many cases where a crime is committed in a room between two close people, disrespecting a superior commission officer, for example, and it's somebody's word against another. An accused can hold the government to their burden of proving the elements of the case beyond a reasonable doubt, or they can take the stand and directly contradict that evidence. So I don't see a tension there with respect to future instances of government charging this case where a victim is asleep and the victim makes an allegation and the government charges it that way. I mean, the appellant has to play the hand that's dealt him at that point.
Thank you. Moving to a different question, you said in your opening that there was no exclusion of the res gestae. And in my questioning of appellant's counsel, he said, well, actually, the military judge did rule that you couldn't bring in the res gestae evidence. And all the stuff that came afterwards was more in the nature of a sort of abortive motion to reconsider. But there actually was a ruling that the hickeys couldn't come in as res gestae evidence. And then all the stuff about moving on, that was in appellant's characterization, that was more in the nature of attempting to get the reconsideration, and that didn't go anywhere.
Your Honor, if I'm not mistaken, I think at trial, when they called the closed hearing, I don't know that the accused ever asked specifically for reconsideration. I mean, our position, which I believe accords with the appellant's position, was that the ruling actually happened pre-trial at the 39A. The ruling was, this evidence doesn't come in. And I agree with your read of the transcript of that. When the military judge said this would be res gestae if it happened during the offense, But there simply was never anything to tie these marks to the Fifth. The military judge, Judge Watkins' observation at the 39A pretrial was that, well, had they been from the encounter that gave rise to the charge, that would be res gestae. However, the appellant, the accused never offered any evidence to connect those two dots. So,
well, I think, and I don't want to put words in the appellant's mouth, but I think the appellant's counsel was that the ruling then came later on JA 356 and 357 before the second judge, where they wanted to bring it in, and the judge said, no, you've already been ruled against you. And they said, well, but Your Honor, there were hickeys on two different dates. And after getting that ruling by the military judge, they kind of argued a little bit, and he's saying they didn't say reconsideration, but they were essentially not reconsidering Judge Watkins' ruling, but reconsidering the second judge's implicit ruling by saying you've already been ruled against on that.
I think that's correct. Again, I don't think that the trial judge made a ruling.
But even if we assume that the trial judge didn't make a ruling on the res gestae, that the military judge said, no, you can't bring in the hickeys when they brought up the res gestae evidence. Military judge at that time didn't quite understand that there was hickeys from both the third and the fourth, made the ruling, and then there was this sort of attempt to get the second military judge to reconsider, although they didn't actually use those words. I'm just asking you to respond to what I perceive to be the appellant's argument.
Well, the 39A judge didn't misunderstand that there were marks from two separate encounters. That argument was only suggested by defense counsel. There was no evidence. And counsel can't just proffer. I mean, counsel's argument is not a proffer of evidence. So I don't think he misunderstood. I think he was explaining to defense counsel that had this been from the charged encounter, it would be res gestae evidence. But failing to do that, what he had before him was evidence of this encounter that he was going to exclude evidence of whole cloth, for the reasons that he later articulated in his findings.
Thank you.
There was no abuse of discretion here, Your Honor. The military judge correctly applied the laws. He made no mistakes of fact. And even if this panel does find that there was error, there was no prejudice. The strength of the government's case was pretty self-evident to the panel members. As I mentioned, there's the tampon evidence that the victim explained she had a tampon in during the encounter. It was later when she discovered the tampon a couple days later that this whole incident kind of was driven home to her. She was devastated by this encounter. Why did this happen while I was asleep? She called her mother that day. She later had a journal entry where she described this. And not for nothing, the appellant lied about the encounter, which would also go to the relative weaknesses of the defense's case.
Captain Hopkins, yes, what about the defense claim that, aside from all the 412 argument, the fact that the accused could have used this incident as impeachment evidence? In other words, he knew the victim was going to deny that this episode on the third ever happened. And so along with other impeachment evidence that he might use when the victim testified later on, he could use this as well.
Your Honor, with respect to the impeachment argument, if that was the primary concern of appellant to ask the question to impeach her credibility, he could have simply asked, isn't it true that you lied to the government on 15 July, I believe is when the government interview was. He could have asked that question. Now, he would have been stuck with her answer. But if his concern was impeaching her credibility, that was an option that was available to him. Pending further questions.
Any questions from the bench? Okay,
yes,
Captain Hopkins, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hockenberry, I believe you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. No rebuttal. Any questions?
Any questions from the bench? Okay, thank you.
Oh, wait, I got to think about this for a second here. I wasn't expecting you to have no rebuttal. What, in your opinion, at this point, is the evidence of participation specifically that the judge excluded? Is it these hickeys or these marks on, you know, that your client says were put on him at the actual encounter, the offense? Is that the evidence of participation that you're referencing specifically in the granted issue?
Yes, sir. Yeah, it seems uncontested that appellant had hickeys on him in that time frame. The defense theory was that some of them came from the third, some of them came from the charged offense. I don't know what the government theory is because they don't contest that the hickeys existed, but they also say she was asleep on the fifth and the third never happened. So, I mean, I think the panel should have at least heard about it and been able to make a determination. She was lying about one or the other.
Let me ask you this then. If the court disagrees with you and says, no, the judge did not abuse his discretion with regard to the actual events that occurred or alleged to have occurred on the third, and all we're left with is the exclusion of these marks on the night of the offense, what is the prejudice from that, in your view? In other words, putting aside the fact, the court decides that the military judge did not abuse his discretion on the incidents and the evidence that occurred on the 3rd of May, and now you're left with the second half of the granted issue, this exclusion of evidence that, in your view, was evidence of participation by the victim on the night of the offense. And having had that excluded, what would be the prejudicial effect of that?
Your Honor, I think it would be significant if the
You know what I'm asking, right? You know what I'm asking? I'm asking only with regard to that specific piece of evidence.
Right. Well, Your Honor, someone who is asleep does not give hickeys to someone who is assaulting her. If the panel accepted that those were given to appellant during the charged event, that would almost conclusively result in an acquittal. In terms of the materiality of the evidence, the fact that she was kissing him when the government portrayed her as asleep is extremely material.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, the case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will be adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. Court is adjourned until further order of the court.